Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Lynn Malcolm. Welcome to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National. Today, we explore the limits on technology. While neuroscience and biomedicine speed ahead at an awesome pace, what are the curly legal and ethical issues which may influence or even slow technology's seemingly unlimited progress? And how much regulation is needed for both scientists and society? UK Professor Roger Brownswood, Professor of Law at King's College London, was in Australia last year to deliver this 2008 Deakin Lecture in Melbourne. Your host is ABC Radio National's Natasha Mitchell.
Roger Brownswood is Professor of Law at King's College London and Director of what's called TELOS. He helped set that centre up. It's the Centre for Technology, Ethics, Law and Society, and his special interest is in bioethics and the regulation of technology. He's also an honorary Professor of Law at the University of Sheffield, and since 2004, he's been a member of what's called the Nuffield Council of Bioethics in the UK. So he's right there in the conversations about regulation. And he's also acted as a special advisor to the House of Lords Select Committee on Stem Cells and to the House of Commons Science and Technology Select Committee on Hybrid Embryos. So these are embryos that combine non-human animal cells and human cells. He's a co-author of many books. Some of them include Mice, Morality and Patents, Human Dignity in Bioethics and Biolaw, many others. His latest is called Rights, Regulation and the Technological Revolution. Let's give him a huge welcome. Thank you.
I'm going to talk about regulating technologies in the way that Natasha's already foreshadowed. And the bookends for this talk are given by a 19th century novel written by a rather strange guy called Samuel Butler. The novel for which Butler is well known is called, it's an unlikely title, it's called Erewhon. If you just play around with the words in Erewhon, particularly try reading it backwards, and you'll see it's pretty close to nowhere. It's not quite, but it's basically an anagram of nowhere. And the fictitious country that Butler introduces us to in Erewhon is like nowhere. Butler, as a young man, thought he ought to see the world, and his travels took him to New Zealand, and allegedly it was during the time of his visit to New Zealand that he was inspired to write this book about Erewhon, where things are systematically inverted. In the story, the central character spends some time by the coast, but then he decides to venture off inland, goes over mountain ranges, deep gorges and ravines, before he arrives at this country, Erewhon. And what he finds in Erewhon is a complete surprise. And I'm going to highlight three of the surprising features of the attitudes and custom and practice in Erewhon, which, as I say, give us some bookends for this particular talk today. The first thing that we find in Erewhon is that the attitude towards criminals is hugely sympathetic and understanding. Yo, you poor thing, you've committed a crime. I hope you soon get over it, soon get better. This is the way Erewhonians treat their criminals. On the other hand, and secondly, those who are ill go to extraordinary lengths in Erewhon to avoid being detected or found ill, because it's a real sin to be ill in Erewhon. If you're found ill, people called the straighteners come and pay you a visit, and the experience with the straighteners is not a pleasant one at all. You don't want to be straightened in Erewhon. So the Erewhonians take a very negative view indeed about being ill. In a sense, you understand already how it's kind of upside down in Erewhon, because on the one hand, the criminals are treated as though they're sick, and the sick are treated as though they're criminals. But most bizarrely, perhaps, the third feature of Erewhonian practice is that the Erewhonians were quite a high-tech society, quite technologically sophisticated, but one day they were persuaded by a local professor, as Butler says, from the University of Unreason. The professor of Unreason persuaded the Erewhonians that they should destroy all their machines, lest the machines got too smart for them and did them no favours. Well, Butler just enjoys poking fun at this fictitious community, but he's also very clever in the way he kind of plays it back at us, the readers, saying, oh, you think you're smart as well, don't you? But maybe you aren't just quite as smart as you think. Because is this vision of life in Erewhonia, back there in the 1870s or 80s when Butler wrote Erewhon, is it so absurd? Now, let me just offer you some predictions for the 21st century relating to the three bullet points that we've just looked at. Bullet point number one, the way we treat criminals. I predict that as the 21st century goes on, we will take a much more understanding view of criminals. All this stuff about being tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime, yeah, we'll still be tough on the risk presented by criminality, but we'll understand a lot more about the causes of crime, and I predict that our understanding of the causes of crime will encourage us to be more sympathetic. We'll create in the law more mitigation, more excuse, more areas of defence. Very dangerous move for us to make. We don't want to let people off the hook too easily, but I think the science will encourage us to make moves of this kind. Secondly, I'm even more confident about the second prediction, which is that as this 21st century unravels, we will increasingly be held responsible for being ill. We will find ourselves in a culture where many diseases, as indeed is already the case, are seen as being preventable. You sit out in the sun too long and get sunburnt or worse, you know that you're taking a risk. At the moment, you might say, well, that's just imprudent, not a wise thing to have done, learn from your mistake. But as populations age, as healthcare resources become more stretched, my prediction here is that we will be increasingly held responsible, held to account for our own illnesses, where these illnesses are judged to be preventable. And I suppose that taking this to its logical conclusion, if we are able to prevent the emergence of disease and disorder by filtering it out in pregnancy, then we will have far more invasive screening during pregnancies with implicit pressure to terminate pregnancies where the children who would otherwise be born are going to be carriers of diseases that are going to be seen as too socially costly. Okay? Prevention rather than cure, risk management will be the culture that develops on the back of science through the 21st century. That is my second prediction. As for the third prediction about getting rid of the machines, no, I don't think there's much prospect of that. I was really saddened to see when I was just walking around Melbourne the other day, and I went along admiring the general post office downtown, which of course is no longer a post office but some retailing opportunity. Inside the general post office there, just as you go in the door, there's an information notice that tells visitors that on the day before 9/11, actually, on September the 10th, 2001, there was a terrible fire at the post office. Much of the original building was destroyed, and a computer did it. So those who thought, let's get rid of the computers, you know, they had their point. But I don't think we will. I think that there will be concerns about some technological developments. People will say, as they have done already, let's pause, let's have a moratorium. I think here in Victoria, for example, where nanotechnology is already a big industry, there will be concerns about the kind of particles that are going into sunscreens, cosmetics, and that kind of thing. People might be saying, hang on a minute, should we be releasing these products into the market before we know exactly what we're doing? So I think there will be plenty of cries for pausing, but I don't think, as in Erewhonia, we will actually get rid of the machines. Now, my central questions for today, I'll come back to Butler and those three predictions at the end, but my central question is to do with the way we should relate and try to understand and explore the interface between regulation and today's emerging technologies, nanotechnology, neurotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, the convergence between these technologies. And in the book that Natasha's kindly advertised, Rights, Regulation, and Technological Revolution, I say that there are two aspects of this interface that I think we should be exploring. One aspect, one set of questions, concerns getting the regulatory environment right for these technologies, for these emerging technologies, getting the regulatory environment right. This is a major challenge. The other set of questions, equally interesting and difficult, is to examine the way that features of these new technologies are being seized upon as regulatory opportunities by the regulators. DNA profiling, CCTV, RFID, we can track and trace and observe and survey people in ways that are far more sophisticated than we've ever had in the past. For a forensic point of view, these seem to be very important tools to be made use of. But the question is, what damage, what corrosion do we do to the kind of community we have as we rely on these technological devices? So one set of questions is to do with setting the regulatory environment, the other to do with making use of technologies as regulatory tools. And so the agenda in this talk is, first of all, for me to address this question of getting the regulatory environment right. Secondly, to deal with the question of using technology as a regulatory tool. And thirdly, to come back to Butler and the Erewhonians briefly at the end. Getting the regulatory environment right is the first of these challenges. And here I think there are four, as it were, sub-challenges, four central challenges for regulators who are trying to grapple with these new technologies. And these challenges are respectively to do with setting standards that are judged by the community to be legitimate, the challenge of regulatory legitimacy. Secondly, effectiveness, making sure that the regulation bites, that we have compliance, that regulation is effective. Thirdly, a problem that is characteristic of all these technologies because of the speed at which they emerge and develop, the problem or the challenge of regulatory connection. This is the challenge of how we keep the regulatory standards, the regulatory framework connected to technologies as they move on. And fourthly, in a global governance setting where we have international and regional and local national regimes of regulation, there's a challenge of cosmopolitanism, which is a double-edged challenge. It's a challenge of making sure that we can identify and enforce standards that are of universal application, but at the same time recognize the need for cultural local diversity and legitimate local difference. So I want to say a few words about each of these challenges. The first one of which is, as I say, the challenge of regulatory legitimacy. Now, we're fairly undemanding of regulators, provided they're in the right kind of ballpark and seem to be doing the right kind of thing, then we don't ask too many difficult questions of them normally. But here, when I say we expect the regulation to be legitimate, we are actually being quite demanding because we're saying we expect these standards to be ethically clean. It's not enough, for example, to say, look, the regulatory framework in the UK in relation to the use of human embryos for research is pretty permissive because we think that this will be conducive to the production of medical benefits, that there will be important therapies produced as a result of this, or in this kind of environment. Or indeed to say, if we don't have this kind of environment, biotech will move off into other parts of the world where the environment is more hospitable, so there are good commercial or economic reasons for doing this. This is all true, but if we think categorically that we should not be making use of human embryos as research tools, these more general background regulatory purposes won't suffice. So this is quite demanding. We're saying this has to be legitimate. It has to pass ethical muster. We want to make sure that where we're drawing the lines, where we're drawing the limits, where we're saying this should not happen, this must not be done, this is prohibited, as, for example, we prohibit reproductive human cloning. We want to make sure that the lines are drawn in the right place. They mustn't be too tight. Otherwise, researchers are too cramped, technologies are too cramped, but they mustn't be too loose, too slack, otherwise we allow too much to go on that we think should be halted. And as a result, each of the technologies has already developed an ethical discourse alongside the technologies. So for some time, of course, we've had bioethics, there's cyber ethics, which thinks about the ethical challenges presented by information technology. Barbara mentioned in her talk the other night that there's neuroethics. And I've just written an article for a journal, which is only volume two, so a new journal called Nanoethics. Each of these technologies has cultivated its own ethical discourse, quite rightly. But although, here I would say, although the technology differs from one sector to another, the profile, the shape of the ethical debate is very similar no matter where you are in this technological world. And the pattern of ethical debate that we find is nowadays essentially one where people are coming from three corners in the following way. And say that generally, those who argue about ethics will be looking forward consequentially and saying, let's make sure that what we do here is productive of benefit, that we avoid risk. This is characteristic of the way people in science and medicine tend to think about their activities as being ethically okay. Historically, and particularly in the second half of the 20th century, major efforts have been made to put some constraints, side constraints, on science so that it doesn't just operate like a juggernaut without taking any account of the interests of individuals. And so there's been a huge movement in favor of individual rights, human rights, that researchers, that the state must always recognise and respect the interests of individuals. And the way this translates out in practice in particular is that we attach huge importance to informed consent. People should not be co-opted into research trials or studies without their informed consent. Patients should not be treated in hospitals or in clinical settings without their informed consent. If it weren't for informed consent, there'd be an awful lot of criminal violence being done in operating theatres and elsewhere in the health sector. But, of course, with consent, the rights are neutralised. There is an authorisation. And the third corner from which people argue about the ethics is a duty corner, where those protagonists are saying, no, it's not about the consequences, and it's not about individual rights. What we should be starting with is thinking about our duties, our responsibilities, our obligations.
You're with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National Summer, and Roger Brownswood, UK Professor of Law at King's College London, is discussing the limits on technology at the 2008 Deakin Lectures.
Okay, now, this could articulate substantively in many different ways, but the way it does typically articulate at the moment is, as per the second bullet point there, the so-called bioethical triangle. But you'd find this triangle replicated, I think, in relation to nano, neuro, or information technologies. And this is the way it goes, that the people who are consequentialists think like utilitarians. They say what we must try to do is maximise human welfare, try and minimise distress. That's the right thing to do. The human rights people come along with their array of rights, whatever they might be, to personal integrity, to privacy, confidentiality, and so on. And they would say, look, these rights must be respected. One way that you can get rights clearance is from the rights holder, who will give their consent. But if rights holders say no, then that should be respected. That should block the move. But most interestingly, I think, most distinctively, we have in the third corner, from those who believe that duties are the key to this, an alliance of positions that I've called the Dignitarian Alliance, where people say that the highest duty that we have as humans is to act in ways that show respect for human dignity, that do not involve the compromising of human dignity. And this has become quite a joker in the pack. Very difficult to be sure quite what it is that people who are argued from this corner are saying. I mean, you'd hear this kind of conversation where someone would say, for example, I think that trade in human organs compromises human dignity. And you say, well, in what way exactly? What's the problem there? In what way does it compromise human dignity? And they say, well, look, I've just said it. It compromises human dignity. If you don't get it, I can't really tell you. That's it. It's wrong. And I'll give you an example, if I may, which has nothing to do with technologies, but which does highlight the different takes on human dignity. And it's a slightly unlikely example, which baffles most audiences, but I hope here in Australia it makes some sense, because I am assured that this particular activity is known in Australia, one of the few parts of the world where it does go on. And the story is that in the 1990s, in two areas in provincial France, the magistrates decided that they would ban an activity which is variously known as dwarf throwing or dwarf tossing. And I believe that there is a certain amount of this kind of activity going on in Australia, which is why I say I hope you understand what I am talking about. If you don't understand what I mean by dwarf tossing or dwarf throwing, I do mean literally throwing little people, throwing dwarfs. This is what we're talking about. And it's done in clubs, and people who do it are consenting adults. Okay, and people do not normally get harmed. Okay. But the French magistrates in these two particular areas thought that this compromised the French idea of human dignity. And so they issued bans on dwarf throwing in nightclubs in their areas. Now, one of the dwarfs, who would otherwise be unemployed, a guy called Manuel Wackenheim, thought that this was wrong. And he brought a challenge to the bans, a legal challenge. He said, this is unconstitutional. And he took this case all the way to the highest court, the Conseil d'État. And his argument was, look, you're telling me that dwarf throwing compromises human dignity. Let me tell you how it looks from my point of view, because if you stop me working and earning a gainful living this way, this will mean I'll have to go back and claim state benefit, live on welfare. And I don't think that's a very dignified form of existence. So if you can't have it both ways. You're saying we have to do this for the sake of human dignity. I'm saying, says Manuel Wackenheim, that you should allow me to do this, that no one's getting hurt. We are consenting adults, okay? And the essence of human dignity, respect for human dignity, is respecting my choice to make my living this way. Okay, I know many of you would not want to make your living this way. And if you had other choices, or if I had other choices, maybe I'd make a living some other way. But look, this is how it is. However, the French court ruled that this did compromise human dignity, that this did not comport with the French idea of a civilized life, and that was it. Now, you find people from, particularly Catholic communities, people who have a Kantian philosophy, people who are communitarians, often will warm to this idea of human dignity because they think there are some technological activities or applications which ought to be regarded as categorically off limits. Okay, and this is a very important constituency to take account of as we're trying to develop standards that are regarded as legitimate all around the patch. The only other thing I'd say about ethics is that there are no neutral havens out there. There are no safe ports. I've heard people talking about consent on and off in the last couple of days, and you might think that consent is a neutral currency that we can rely on without having to commit ourselves to a particular ethical point of view. But it's not the case. Believe me, what you make of consent, whether you think it's important or not, how you think it should be operationalized, will depend entirely where you're coming from, whether you're a utilitarian, a rights theorist, or a dignitarian. The dignitarians don't think consent matters at all. It's just a sideshow. You can't switch these duties on and off by giving consent. The fact that people were consenting to dwarf throwing didn't make a jot of difference. They were compromising human dignity. On the other hand, if you're a rights theorist, you'll think consent is absolutely crucial. And the same goes, although I haven't got time to tell you how, but the same goes for common ideas like precaution, where people say we should apply the precautionary principle or a precautionary approach. Absolutely, you know, a barrel of trouble, because it's laden with the ideas that it's bringing in from utilitarian rights or dignitarian perspectives. And the same's true of that million, very popular British starting point that we should ask ourselves, is this activity causing harm to others? Unless it's causing harm to others, we shouldn't be prohibiting it. But the idea of harm is deeply problematic, and who counts as another? That too is inherently contestable. It just depends where you're coming from, what you make of these key ideas. So if we're talking about the challenge of legitimacy, which I say is a tough challenge, unless we happen to be in a part of the world where culture is extremely homogeneous and people identify themselves with shared values, then the chances of finding a standard which will be perceived to be legitimate by all constituencies in that community is extremely unlikely. And of course, certainly in Europe and certainly in the UK, we live in highly pluralistic communities where people do have very different views about these matters and rightly debate their differences, but it does mean that regulators face an uphill struggle if they are to establish a position which commands the confidence of all areas of the community in relation to the legitimacy of the standards. I'm going to say just a few words about the other three challenges. I'm conscious that otherwise I won't be able to say very much about the other parts of the presentation. So let me just alert you to this. Regulatory effectiveness. Well, law, like attempts at human reproduction, is actually very ineffective, and probably in the latter case a jolly good thing too. But in the former case, not so good. Law does not actually work terrifically well. You may think that when we have a law against a particular thing, this means that the activity in question ceases. But unless the regulators are pushing against open doors, this is generally not the case. Australia leads the world in imaginative regulatory thinking. There's a group of people up at ANU, the Braithwaites, Christine Parker, Neil Gunningham, an old Sheffield graduate, and it's great to see some old Sheffield friends here today, and Peter Grabowski. These are world leaders in regulatory thinking, and they've thought about all sorts of styles of regulation that are more smart, more responsive, better prospects of being effective than old-fashioned, straightforward criminal law command and control thinking. But even there, they are facing difficulties. There are no really applicable general lessons to be learned. We have to deal with these things on a case-by-case basis because there is resistance out there. Businesses are going to resist regulation if there's a business cost associated with it. You can go on endlessly about corporate social responsibility, for example. You say, it's a very good thing. Yeah, corporations should show more social responsibility. They should have more green policies. They should worry about their employees. But unless there's a business case for this kind of responsibility, it's going to be difficult to persuade corporations that this is the way they should run their business. So we're looking for win-win situations where businesses can respond in the right kind of way. But of course, it's not just businesses, professions too defend jealously their professional codes of conduct. They don't like regulators coming along, medics, researchers, lawyers. We don't like people telling us how to do our business. We think we know how to do it. We think we can do it better in the light of our own developed customary standards. So ideally, we would like, if regulation is to be effective, to find it backed by consensus. But in communities that are ethically divided and in communities that are divided by self-interest, by professional tradition and so on, it's going to be rather difficult to find cases where regulation is just pushing against an open door. Now, the third of the challenges is the challenge of regulatory connection. And what better authority on regulatory connection than our old friend John Perry Barlow, who was, as you probably know, one of the lyricists for the band The Grateful Dead. And John Perry Barlow said, I think quite appropriately, that it's the case that law adapts by continuous increments and at a pace second only to geology in its stateliness. Technology advances in lunging jerks, like the punctuation of biological evolution grotesquely accelerated. This is not bad, is it, for someone who was writing lyrics for the Grateful Dead? Real-world conditions will continue to change at a blinding pace, and the law will get further behind, more profoundly confused. This match is permanent. No, this diagnosis is correct, no doubt about it. And in fact, it's a double-edged problem, because the problem arises initially in this way, that regulators do not know at which time, the right time, they should make their regulatory intervention. At the moment, we don't know whether we should be intervening specifically to regulate nanotechnology. We know out there we've got existing regimes of product liability, we've got existing laws relating to health and safety and environmental protection, we've got laws relating to patenting, and nanotech will play against the background of those laws. Whether those laws fit very well or not, that's an open question. Some places they fit better than others. Should regulators make a kind of deliberate, focused intervention here with nanotechnology? And the answer is we don't know whether this is the right time to intervene or not, because the technology is still immature. When we do intervene, we can have a good shot at it, but we will be sure that however we've intervened, the technology will just move on at a rapid pace and the law will be left behind. So that in England, we found both data protection law outstripped by developments in information technology, and we found in embryology, the Human Fertilization Embryology Act, which we were so pleased with in 1990, seriously out of date and needing to be revised. Okay, there are some connecting strategies. And the fourth challenge, which I have to pass over here to get into the next part of the talk, it's to do with cosmopolitanism. But remember, this is the challenge about putting in place universal standards, maybe to do with human rights or human dignity, but at the same time, recognizing that local communities should have some margin of appreciation or some opportunity to express their own particular cultural diversity. Okay, so moving on to the second, and I'll deal with this quite quickly, but clearly very controversial development and set of questions arising from the interface between regulation and technology. We need to think hard about the take-up of these new technologies as part of the regulatory apparatus. The traditional way of regulating has been to try to reason with people. The traditional way has been to say, look, here's the law. You have the option of compliance or non-compliance. If you don't comply, then there's a prospect that you will be caught, you'll be convicted, you'll be punished. In morality, we try to reason with people. Even in the market, we try to appeal to the purse. We appeal to reason there too. Okay. Now, as these technologies insinuate themselves into the criminal justice system, the way in which regulators reason with their regulatees changes. And indeed, it might reach a point where regulators give up on reasoning with their regulatees. You are simply presented with a fait accompli. Okay, so now in the UK, as I've said, we controversially have developed the largest DNA profiling collection per capita in the world. There are over 4 million DNA profiles retained on the database. We're waiting for a decision from the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg to tell us whether our legal framework is compatible with our human rights obligations. We'll get that decision at the end of the summer. It'll be very interesting to see what they say, because we are badly out of line, but badly out of line with other European countries and with the world generally. I mean, we've even got more profiles than they have in the States. So we are a world leader, but whether it's a good thing to be a world leader in is not clear. And the same goes with CCTV and generally surveillance. It's said that in the UK, you are captured on a CCTV camera at least 300 times a day. And I can well believe that that is the case. I gave a paper in one of the city firms not so long ago, Herbert Smith, where I think there were 8 CCTV cameras in the room where we were actually having the meeting. Big debates about biometric identifiers so the state can establish whether we are who we seem to be. But generally, the whole process of watching, observing, of surveilling, knowing who we are, what we're doing, where we are, is something that we see increasingly being brought into the criminal justice system. And when our judges comment on this, they comment on it very favorably. Judges have even said that we should extend our 4 million profile DNA database to become a population-wide DNA database, that everyone in the UK should have their DNA profile on the system. Wouldn't that be a powerful resource for forensic purposes? Yeah, good or a bad thing? Well, that's something we might like to talk about.
This is Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National, and you're listening to UK Professor of Law Roger Brownswood delivering a 2008 Deakin Lecture, The Limits on Technology.
Now, if I can ask you just to project a little bit into the future, the technologies will, I think, get to a point where it is in principle possible for the ultimate technological fix to be applied, whether this be through biotech or neurotech, I don't know, but sometime in the future there, or simply architectural, as we do sometimes these days, where we redesign roads so that it's just not possible to exceed a particular speed. And what we're finding here is that regulators are now being presented with a fait accompli. They might not even realise that the situation is one where their conduct is being regulated. There is no longer any option of non-compliance. We're designing out or coding out or designing in and coding in appropriately. Now, if we assume that the state is a benign state with good moral intentions and that the pattern of behaviour that's produced is respecting the moral principles we think should be respected, you might well say, isn't that a jolly good thing? After all, we've complained for years about criminal justice saying that nothing works, getting desperate. And here we have something that works wonderfully well. Shouldn't we celebrate this? But seems to me the problem here is not just a problem about privacy, which is commonly cited as a problem about the surveillance society. The problem here is that a moral community, a community with moral aspirations, needs a certain sort of context in which to develop moral virtue. And I think that one of the aspects that matters here is that we need to have the opportunity, paradoxically, to act in bad ways. In other words, it's very difficult for us to develop moral virtue, to be good people, without also having the opportunity to be bad people. And the more we eliminate through the technology these risks of antisocial or immoral behaviour, the more we change the context, the way which makes it more difficult for us to develop the virtues. There are some famous dystopian visions that portray societies that have taken the technological path. George Orwell, Aldous Huxley in particular. And one of the conversations in Huxley's Brave New World is a conversation between Mustafa Mond, who is one of the coordinators of in the New World, and the native, you know, who's come back in from the reservation. And Mond is saying to the native, what a wonderful thing it is to take your daily dose of soma, makes life so much easier. He says, anybody can be virtuous nowadays. You can carry at least half your morality about in a bottle. Christianity without tears, that's what soma is. And again, in a book that, if you don't know it, I couldn't recommend it sufficiently strongly, Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess, the narrator, Alex, in this book, and in the first third of the book, we just read about Alex's brutality and thuggery before he's caught and convicted. But Alex is put through a new process of aversion therapy, so-called Ludovico's technique, and he is the first graduate from the institute that has applied this particular technique. And in order to show the people from the ministry how wonderfully successful this technique is, they arrange a demonstration where Alex is given, the reformed Alex, the reclaimed Alex, is given the opportunity to assault, I think, a woman. And he is physically repelled by this prospect, and everybody thinks, well, nearly everybody thinks, that this is a wonderful demonstration of how wonderful this works. But throughout throughout the book, and here in particular, the chaplain, who's been observing the process, is uneasy. He's uncomfortable about what he's seeing. And he expresses this disease in the following way. He says, look, Alex has no real choice, has he? Self-interest, fear of physical pain, drove him to that grotesque act of self-abasement. He ceases to be a wrongdoer. He ceases also to be a creature capable of moral choice. And to which Dr. Brodsky, who's the lead scientist developing Ludovico's technique, says, look, these are subtleties. We're not concerned with motive. We're not concerned with the higher ethics. We are concerned only with cutting down crime. And if crime control is the only game in town, then we will use these technologies to cut down crime, even if it means we pay some price morally. The US President's Council, led by Leon Kass, who is an arch-dignitarian, and, of course, has been advised by a council that's been advised by Francis Fukuyama, who, again, is someone who has, you know, dignitarian tendencies, I think. In their Beyond Therapy report in 2003, the President's Council issue a warning about, for example, the use of drugs like Ritalin, which Barbara was talking about last night, as a way of keeping unruly kids in line. And just towards the middle of this particular quote from the report, you'll see that the council say, if what matters is only the child's outward behaviour, then this is simply a more effective and efficient means of achieving the desired result. But because moral education is typically more about the shaping of the agent's character than about the outward act, the process of learning to behave appropriately matters most of all. You know, this is the tension. If we give it a technological fix, do we do so at the price of preventing progressive moral personal development? If, on the other hand, you're prepared to, say, give people room to develop their morality by trial and error, then there will be some errors, there will be some risks, there will be some unruliness, okay? So, with those thoughts about the adoption of technology as a regulatory tool, which I predict is going to be a pattern of regulation, as regulators get smarter, one of the lessons they will learn is that technology gives them tools that they really ought to apply and that they can apply effectively. The sort of headline question is, even if this means regulation is more effective, does it mean it's more legitimate? Or are we paying a price in terms of legitimacy? And so just finally, to go back to the Erewhonians and the three proposals that the Erewhonians might put in front of us in the 21st century. First of all, the proposal that we should that those who commit crime should be treated as deserving of sympathy and not punished. That's not to say that we shouldn't manage the social risk presented by those who offend, in inverted commas. Okay, we have to have some mechanism of social defense and social control. But the old-fashioned way of punishing, holding people responsible, is something perhaps we need to re-examine. And secondly, the proposal that we should hold people responsible, we should really hold people responsible for getting ill where illness is preventable, or for having kids that have diseases that are preventable. And thirdly, that there should be a moratorium on the development of new technologies. Are those sensible proposals? Would we agree with those? In relation to the first proposal, which is against blame and punishment for crime, I think that the one we need to keep our eye on here is neuroscience. The more we understand about the brain, the more we open up the brain to inquiry, the more we understand what we are, and what we find here might not be quite what we like. I mean, I've heard people say this is just, you know, Pandora's box that we should not open, okay? Because we have a certain view of what we are. We're very unusual creatures, humans. We hold a mirror up to ourselves and reflect on what we are. And historically and socially, culturally, we think we have something called free will. Now, it's a pretty funny idea at the best of times, free will, but it translates out in legal and moral discourse as meaning we are largely responsible for our actions. We're largely in control. We make choices, okay? We make bad choices. We do bad things. We're held to account. We're rightly punished. We're rightly blamed. This model of agency is so fundamental to the whole practice of law and morality. I think it's just culturally embedded. But neuroscience could challenge this. Now, neuroscience could say, look, you know, the brain's just another organ. It's just a bit of biology, highly sophisticated bit of biology. But there's not a little man in there making a choice. There's not a little man in there that you can equate with free will. Just show me the part of the brain that equates to free will. It's no good either showing a part of the brain that means that we act in random ways, because if someone acts randomly, then there's no basis for holding them responsible or accountable. No, I mean, it's very difficult indeed to get your heads around this, but neuroscience could well start telling us a story about what we are that suggests that although our mental experience is one, indeed, of being in control, of making choices, this is, as they would say, epiphenomenal, that the real causal track does not actually involve these experiences that we have. Okay? And this puts us in a very peculiar position. Now, those who are very robust about this would say, oh, well, you know, that's brain science. We don't need to worry about that. We can just carry on fine doing the things we've always done. Treat ourselves as being in control, even though they say we're not. Treat ourselves as making choices and being responsible, even though they say that's not really squaring with the science story. I don't think we can hold science at arm's length in that way. I think it would just get too uncomfortable. We would eventually cave into the science, but this looks like a nuclear option. I mean, I just can't even think what this would mean, because if we are being told we don't really make choices at all, we're not really in control, then what is going on? I don't know. Secondly, and I think I've said enough about this already, but to come back to it, I'm reasonably confident that as the century unfolds, we will progressively hold people more responsible for their own health and well-being, where we have much better information about the causes of disease. In the UK, as in a number of other European countries, there are big investments in biobanks, which are big public health projects. In the UK, 500,000 people are being enrolled into the scheme where they give various biological samples, information about lifestyle, medical records, and so on is all taken into account. And the promise of the biobank is that with this longitudinal research, large-scale research, particularly when it's linked up with other biobanks in Europe, we will begin to see the strong connections between certain genetic markers, certain lifestyles, certain environmental influences. Now, if that information is fed back into the community, I don't think it's just going to come back in the form tobacco is dangerous or bad for your health, or alcohol is bad in excess, or whatever. I think it will come back in a much stronger form. Look, here are the facts about the causes of serious medical disorders. Where, as a community, we, through a taxation system, support healthcare, then you have responsibilities to try to trim your obligations, your calls on the healthcare system. If we're dealing with a market for healthcare which is purely private, then people can carry on, I think, behaving as they like, provided they can pay for their healthcare out of their own pockets. We don't need to worry. But in a publicly funded healthcare system, I think the obligation responsibilities of the potential beneficiaries of healthcare will be presented in a way that they must not unduly, unreasonably, and unnecessarily burden the system. Don't get me wrong. I see one or two people shaking their heads. If you're shaking your heads and thinking it's not going to go that way, fine. But don't shake your heads at me as if to say, oh, he's recommending this. I'm not. I'm just, look, you know, I'm just the messenger here. I'm saying I think this is the way it's going to play. Okay. And finally, the third proposal is that we should get rid of the technology, that we should call it a day. And of course, people do. There's a book by Bill McKibben called Enough, which says it all, you know, enough. I can't imagine how I would get the kind of satisfaction that I get in Bill McKibben says about trying to beat the clock in a marathon if I know that my marathon performance is really just genetically determined and it's not really down to me. And there are people like Fukuyama, but perhaps most spectacularly Bill Joy himself, one of the pioneers of modern computer technology, who now says, you know, technology is something that is going to kill us. And the sooner we draw the line on it, the better, because this is dangerous stuff. We are entering a dangerous age when technology is accelerating in its development at a pace we just haven't seen in the past. I mean, there have been big technological breakthroughs in the past. It's hard to compare one period with another. But I don't think there's any doubt that the acceleration and convergence of these technologies is something really new. But although there will be voices arguing that we should be drawing the line on this, I think that so long as people can make money out of the technology and so long as individuals can see medical hope in the technologies, it'd be very difficult indeed in a global economy to draw the line. And so to conclude, I'm sorry that this has gone on, yeah, but the conclusions are that, and everybody's saying this, the emergence of these technologies presents both an opportunity and a challenge. For regulators, the challenge is to get the regulatory environment right. The opportunity is to use these technologies in a way which does make regulation more effective but doesn't compromise legitimacy. And I think the deeper challenge is for regulators to resist using the technologies in a way that corrodes the possibility of the moral life, of moral community. And although we can argue endlessly about whether what's going on in the science is really, by scientific standards, a revolution, so far as regulation is concerned, the co-option of these technologies into the regulatory process, I think, really is a sea change. That is where we do face a regulatory revolution. Now, thanks very much.
Professor Roger Brownswood is Professor of Law at King's College London, and he delivered this 2008 Deakin Lecture in Melbourne. You're listening to our Big Ideas Summer of Science series. And now, here's ABC Radio National's Natasha Mitchell in discussion with Roger Brownswood.
This question of human dignity and its role as an impetus, if you like, for regulation is an interesting one. And I read in the New Republic magazine just last week, Steven Pinker, who's an eminent psychologist at Harvard, some of you might have read some of his work on language, popular writing. This is what he had to say, which I thought was very interesting. He said, the general feeling is that even if a new technology would improve life and health and decrease suffering and waste, it might have to be rejected or even outlawed if it affronted human dignity. And he goes on to say, whatever that is. And he goes on to say even more, the problem is that dignity is a squishy, subjective notion, hardly up to the heavyweight moral standards assigned to it. What do you think of his... And he goes on and he has a great rant. He's mighty against the dignitarians.
Yeah.
What do you think about his take on that?
Okay. Well, this particular article by Steven Pinker is in response to a recent publication by the President's Council, which, as I said in the talk, is a dignitarian body. And the President's Council just recently has published a 500-page collection of papers on the subject of human dignity, saying we realise that this is a hugely important concept in our bioethical ethical thinking. And it's particularly responding to a critique of just the kind that Steven Pinker has made by Ruth Macklin, that was in the British Medical Journal a few years ago, where she was, again, saying very similar things about human dignity, that this was a loose canon, no one really knows what it means, it just becomes a facade for rather conservative, dogmatic thinking to say no to developments that we don't like the look of. I mean, I think there is some integrity to human dignity. You can give it some integrity around ideas about the sanctity of life, about the non-commodification of life, about non-commercialization. It wouldn't just be new technologies. The dignitarians would be against things like the sex trade, where they see human bodies being commodified. They'd be against commercialization of biological samples. They'd be against the patenting of, you know, of human genes. I think there is a coherent agenda there, but in one of the books that that I wrote with Derek Bailivolt in 2001, Human Dignity and Bioethics and Biolaw, our view was that, very much like Steven Pinker's, that the dignitarians are conservatively and dogmatically taking up a position which cannot actually be rationally defended. And so if I were being asked to put my own cards face up on the table, I would be saying we should be approaching these questions from a human rights angle. That, I think, is the most defensible ethical view. But, of course, it has to be said that in an age of scepticism and relativism, I think Robin asked a question about scepticism on the opening night here. People are deeply sceptical about foundations in ethical thinking, and this means that although Pinker might be able to say that the dignitarians ultimately have feet of clay, that they don't stand on terra firma, the same's true of the utilitarians, the same's true of the rights theorists. Unless your intuitions happen to be in that direction, the sceptic will say, we're all in the same boat, and it's leaky.
Roger, there was an interesting case that I saw in the US where the situation for stem cell researchers, for example, has become so difficult over there. There just hasn't been a very inclusive sort of regulatory discussion at the federal government level in the US, right? So they came up, a consortium of scientists with the national academies in the USA decided that they'd set up a set of their own guidelines to govern their own research with embryonic stem cells. And they developed that and they put it out there. So in a sense, that was them in a state of desperation, really, trying to set a set of guidelines for themselves in the absence of any political discussion about that. What did you think about that and generally this question?
Well, generally, I think that scientists do need regulation both for their own protection and for the protection of society. I mean, we've only got to look back into the 20th century to see what happens when scientists who think they're doing the right thing, or think they might be doing, doing the right thing in the collective terms, nevertheless abuse individuals in ways that we just think are totally unacceptable. So there's a historic case for saying that scientists do need to be regulated. I don't think we should ever forget that. And where scientists aren't regulated, we can see already in recent stem cell research history that unregulated scientists can make claims that are completely unfounded, as it turns out. This is not good for anybody, not good for the scientific community, not good for the public. The position in the States, which you were particularly referring to, is especially messy. I think actually in Europe it's messy too, because there are issues here about the ground rules for obtaining funding. So that in the States, the federal funding ground rules apply these particular constraints. But that doesn't mean that people who do their research without any federal funding can't proceed, although, as you say, they sometimes have to go to extraordinary lengths to avoid any public money coming into their research. And, of course, the situation varies from one state to another, so that, California has a big budget for stem cell research, but you find elsewhere that a very different view is taken. So it is messy. I think that for a community to try to develop its own code of practice is probably a sensible thing. But the context in the States may be a bit unusual.
You talk about kind of strong regulation or effective regulation and ineffective regulation. You've got particular terms. I can't remember what they were now. Yeah. Is it possible to have an ideal regulator that can kind of not succumb to the complex maze of interests that are going to impact on their decisions?
Yeah, I said just earlier on that putting my own cards face up on the table, I think that human rights is the position from which we should be coming. And so my idealised community and my idealised regulators would be respectively a community and regulators committed to respect for human rights. But I think that this is as much a matter of process as product. That, in other words, although we have a sense that the direction we want to go in is respect for human rights, and there are some clear landmarks within human rights that we understand are necessary part of this, I think each community must then try and take the project forward in its own distinctive way. And so in a global set of human rights communities, there could be some variations between human rights communities in the Southern Hemisphere and human rights communities in the Northern Hemisphere. I think there must be some tolerance for that. That then means there are some difficulties for those communities when they're trying to establish common ground. But the great thing about this is that at least they do start with the same baseline commitment to human rights. And I think the procedures for resolving community differences have much greater prospects where people do at least start with that same baseline, rather than when you try to resolve differences between dignitarians, utilitarians, and others who have fundamentally different worldviews.
Professor Roger Brownswood from King's College London and director of TELOS, the Centre for Technology, Ethics, Law and Society. His latest book is called Rights, Regulation and the Technological Revolution, and it's published by Oxford University Press. And ABC Radio National's Natasha Mitchell hosted this 2008 Deakin Lecture in Melbourne. Thanks to sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and that was the final in our Summer of Science series for this year. I hope you enjoyed it. For more information and downloadable audio of our Big Ideas Summer of Science, go to abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. The new season of Big Ideas begins next Sunday. We begin with Margaret Atwood's imaginative and engaging 5-part look at the concept of debt. It's been a big hit in Canada and the United States, and we're pleased to bring you the first Australian broadcast right here on Big Ideas, starting next Sunday afternoon at 5. I hope you can join us then on ABC Radio National. Thank you.
listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.